Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm joined today by Alan Beatty from the Financial Times, senior writer on trade. Hello, Alan.
Hello, good morning.
And Alicia joins me, Alicia Garcia Herrero, senior fellow at Bruegel, joins me from Hong Kong. Hello, Alicia.
Hello, Guntram.
Well, today we want to discuss one of the big news of this week, which is the crisis of the WTO, the World Trade Organization's appellate body, which is a body to settle disputes between member states of the WTO, is in crisis. It doesn't have the necessary number of judges to be able to take decisions, which actually renders the whole dispute settlement mechanism of the WTO inoperational for the time being, with potentially major consequences for global trade. And I want to start that conversation with you, Alan, because you were just in Geneva and sort of got a first-hand experience of the mood in Geneva at the WTO. Why don't you start sharing a bit what's the mood like in Geneva, and then tell us a bit where you see the current appellate body crisis.
So I think if I had to sum it up, I'd say the mood was resigned, because this has been obviously coming for quite a while. You know, the US has had the appellate body in its sights for several years. Robert Lighthizer, the US trade representative in particular, has an animus against the appellate body. They say it's overreached, they say it's creating law, and so forth. They say it's acting like a Supreme Court, and they've been pretty consistent on that. And I think it's kind of gradually dawned, possibly too slowly dawned, on the other WTO members that they are in fact serious. So yes, on Tuesday at midnight, it became in court. It's got three or four cases hanging over that it's going to decide, and after that, it won't decide anymore. Now, the issue really looking forward is whether or not the sides can be brought together. It is very largely the US versus everyone else. And the US simply says that, you know, the other countries have not moved towards it enough. They haven't accepted that the appellate body has gone wrong. And so if they're going to resurrect an appellate body within the WTO, there's going to have to be some fairly big, you know, never mind organizational changes, some fairly big shifts in philosophy to bring the sides together.
Well, can we just unpack this issue of overreach, and, you know, whether the appellate body actually works and acts as almost a legislator, like a Supreme Court? I mean, is there some truth to Robert Lighthizer's claims, or is it just a political motivation, perhaps because he's personally disappointed about the appellate body itself, or what's behind it? Is there some truth to it?
I think there is some truth, actually. You know, right back in 1995 when it was created, the aim was it would be a sort of technical revising body. It would look at particular points of law, not of fact, of a minority of cases which had come up from the first stage, from the panel stage, when those had not been sort of adequately looked at. And then over time, it certainly has expanded to the point where I think 90% or so of cases are appealed to it. It's become a routine court of appeal. And there are a lot of issues it has dealt with where, you know, it's saying things which really aren't in the agreements that it interprets. The classic one, and the one that Lighthizer and a lot of the US legal community is exercised about, is an apparently obscure issue called zeroing, which is about how they use anti-dumping, how they use tariffs which they impose against imports that they consider to be unfairly priced unfairly low. They have a particular technique of calculating this called zeroing. Now, there's nothing about it in any of the WTO agreements. It's not even hinted at. But the appellate body has repeatedly said that using zeroing is against WTO rules. And given that some very prominent US industries, such as steel, really want zeroing, that's where some of the, you know, a lot of the tension has come from. Now, zeroing, I consider, and I think most people consider, is kind of ridiculous. It involves ignoring data that you don't like. However, it is kind of true that if you look at the agreement, it's hard to see where you get, you know, textual justification for saying that it's illegal.
Mm. All right. So member states sort of didn't expect the US to pull it through. They pulled it through, so we don't have an appellate body. What's next? I mean, we just live in a world without dispute settlement. Would that ever work, or can we create some alternatives?
Also, the alternative, the big game in town, is the European Union, which has created a kind of ersatz, a synthetic kind of appellate body. And it's signed up a couple of countries already. It signed up Canada and it signed up Norway. And essentially, this just replicates the appellate body. It's perfectly legal under WTO rules, which are quite generous on the subject. And so far, as I say, there are just these two bilateral agreements with smallish countries. What they're trying to do is to put together a critical mass of 20 or so nations, which essentially would just sign a deal with each other. It's kind of like a plurilateral deal, although the EU doesn't call it plurilateral because that has a particular meaning. And so they would essentially set up something quite similar to the existing WTO appellate body, but outside the WTO. Those conversations are ongoing now. I would expect to see some announcements reasonably soon, but it will still take months to set it up just because, you know, it's a legally complex thing to do.
I mean, just to push on that point a little bit further, I mean, an alternative appellate body would, of course, have to include the majority or a large part of the emerging market economies, the smaller economies. I mean, these economies in particular need to have some legal certainty also on their on their own trade dealings, and not be pushed in a corner where just the bigger countries win against them. And then there is, of course, the other big country, which is China, and China apparently is actually contemplating whether or not to join this body. The US obviously wouldn't be part of it, so it's sort of a construction which up to now isn't really there. I mean, it only includes the EU and two further countries. That's certainly not enough. When does it become a real alternative that would almost work as well as the WTO, with a big exception that the US is not part of it?
Well, I think within a few months. I mean, the way it will work is that the countries that the EU is targeting are the big emerging markets like China, Russia, Brazil, partly because, you know, those are the countries that do most of the disputing and litigating within the WTO, so you need those on board. Once you have those on board, obviously those smaller countries that have disputes with the bigger countries, that's in their interest to sign on. China has sounded positive about it. They've not come out and said so in public, but Brazil's quite positive about it. India probably not so much. And so I would expect this to happen in a few months, which is, you know, not a vast amount of time in WTO dispute settlement time, because it tends to move quite slowly. But one thing the EU is extremely keen to do is to say this is not a permanent alternative. They don't want this to be something that indefinitely replaces the dispute settlement body, because they prefer multilateral, you know, to partial. And whether or not...
So they're hoping for a different US president?
Yeah, possibly a different USTR, actually, because I think there's quite a personal thing with Lighthizer, in the sense that he wasn't a lawyer for the steel industry and often tangled with the WTO. He was also nominated, actually, as a member of the appellate body back in 2003 by the George W. Bush administration, and didn't make it on. So there may be some, you know, fairly personal issues there. So it's conceivable you might see this under a Trump presidency with a different USTR, but it would certainly be more likely if you got a different president, yes.
Mm. Well, Alicia, let me bring you into the conversation. You're looking at this from Hong Kong, and obviously have a deep understanding of the Chinese perspective. Would China be happy, from your point of view, to join a sort of alternative dispute settlement? And would that be satisfactory and enough without the US to be in such a system?
Thank you, Guntram. It's a very good question. On the surface, and this is based on China's ambassador to the WTO, Jiang Xiangchen, has actually already expressed support for the EU's vision of an appellate arbitration model. But you know, this is in a way a way to show China's outcry to the US dismantling the WTO. And this sounds very appealing if you think about what the US and China are doing on their side in terms of negotiating a mini phase one trade deal by December 15th, right there. And in a way, it's putting more pressure on the US by accepting, by lying on the EU side on this appellate clone of an appellate body, if I may say. So on the surface, yes, but in essence, the question is how much will China ask in exchange? You know, I mean, we all realize that if China doesn't actually lean towards this clone appellate body, chances are that relevant emerging economies and might not be as keen, and thus China's support is very important for the EU. We happen to be negotiating as we speak, and we've been doing so since November 2013, a bilateral investment agreement with China, and we know that this is very important for China as well. So I can imagine, you know, that there may be discussions around this support other than just nominally going forward towards the EU solution. That's, I think, where we are coming from, because if not, frankly speaking, for China, this is a very good news that there is an appellate body right after the demise of the existing one. Why just support in principle or rather than just really literally sign in the same way as we've seen for Norway and Canada? The fact they haven't, or they haven't even confirmed they will, to me, opens the door for negotiation between the EU and China for China's support.
So is it a mistake, perhaps, from the European Union point of view to seek the Chinese agreement on this, basically playing into the hands of China in its dispute with the US? I mean, aren't we more on the US side in this?
Well, I mean, we may be on the US side on many fronts, but the truth is that we desperately want an appellate body. So on this one, we need China. But I agree with your, you know, what you're hinting at, Guntram, is that, frankly speaking, we should not play the cards that we desperately need China for this to be rolled out, because China will ask for a price, and we are negotiating important stuff for Europe with China at the moment. So that's, and let alone the ultimate reform of the WTO, think about China's, in my humble opinion, stubborn position on keeping this emerging market status. That is something that could be, you know, in the negotiation for this support to the appellate body, let alone the bilateral investment agreement. So we don't know which way it will go, but it sounds to me from the statement from the ambassador that, yes, a negotiation might be going on as we speak.
Ellen, are you worried that that China will extract a big price for its support, or is it not in their self-interest to just join and, you know, have a functioning global dispute settlement system?
Well, if you listen to their rhetoric, you know, they like the WTO, they like the multilateral process. They've obviously done pretty well out of it because it helped them to integrate into the world economy. One problem is, though, that they've never really shown much inclination to pay into it, as it were, to make more concessions in order to keep the thing going. You know, there's one or two obvious things that they could do. As Lisa says, giving up their special status as a developing country would be one of them. Another would be to accept changes to the rules such that a lot more government support to industry was counted as subsidies, which could be restricted or, in fact, prohibited under WTO rules. And the US, the EU, and Japan are putting together a paper about subsidies and trying to expand the definition of subsidies. Now, China gives every impression of suggesting that if and when that suggestion gets to the WTO, it will be dead on arrival. You know, there would actually be quite a lot of logic in expanding the rules, because one of the reasons the appellate body has gone so far and has been judicially creative is because it's had to fill gaps in the rules because the rules are so weak. I mean, you know, there have been no substantive rule changes, not really, since 1995. And a lot of the tools that China uses as part of its development strategy just weren't envisaged or aren't really covered. So that would make some sort of logical sense. However, China hasn't shown much inclination. It's been quite a free rider. So whether or not it's actually prepared to make any concessions rather than try to extract them, you know, is quite doubtful.
Well, China has been some sort of a free rider. that's a strong statement. And obviously, one big concern is that state subsidies and the SOE business in China is not fully addressed in the WTO framework, and that China is often accused of actually being quite missing significant parts of its notification duties towards the WTO when it comes to notification of subsidies, making the settlement of disputes and the discussion around state subsidies actually very, very complicated at the WTO. So in the end, do we end up with a system where the country that's free riding is joining while the other country that wasn't free riding supposedly is leaving, and the EU is on the side of the free riding country? Alicia, where do you see that?
On the appellate body itself, you mean? Put it this way. I would argue that the appellate body, and I think I fully agree with Alan, is just like a patch, you know, like a temporary solution to all of the other things we're discussing on the WTO reform. So, you know, for China to put a price to the patch would be a little bit beyond, you know, what you should be doing if you want to be considered kind of part of this reform. But I wouldn't fully discount it. So again, I would say, yes, we're, you know, on the side of the free rider, even on the path side, because, and this is, I think, quite important, China has been getting ready to the possibility of the appellate body not functioning, perhaps you may say embryonically, rightly so, but indeed getting ready, because it has created two international commercial courts in the last year and a half, I believe, one in the north in Xi'an and one in the south, and, you know, with the idea of covering commercial cases for Belt and Road kind of geographies, but it's not written in stone that they have to be Belt and Road in geographies. So in other words, already thinking that they would need indeed, their own international commercial courts. That doesn't, of course, substitute the appellate body. But I'm saying, I think perhaps, I would say maybe more than Europe in a way, they've been thinking this would happen. This would certainly happen. They were very, very worried about the appellate body not functioning for a long time, attaching a very big probability to this event. So in that regard, you know, if you are getting ready, maybe not yet there, the price or the cost or the price you attach to the patch might be higher than it would have been otherwise. So the answer, Guntram, would be probably yes. We are in a way surrounded by countries, one of which, the largest, might actually be again playing, you know, in this patch exercise with some kind of advantage.
Alan, any views on this particular point?
The Chinese court setting up its own courts is kind of interesting, and I guess we'll see how they evolve. One thing I would say is that to the extent that any of these dispute settlements have a sort of a political context, and, you know, certainly the WTO appellate body has a political context, or much more so, it kind of remains to be seen how much any court that China sets up is actually going to be free in reality from Chinese influence, from the sense that, you know, this is one extremely large country which is set the courts up and is dominating them. So I think that would be my one thought on that.
Well, going forward, I mean, perhaps sort of to end this conversation and also think about the year ahead. This is a year. This year has been a year full of trade news. Trade used to be quite technical and basically a topic for the bureaucrats. It has become a top political agenda item, certainly this year, perhaps already last year. Going forward, next year is going to be again a big year. Where do we see world trade in a year's time, with the US-China trade conflict, with the WTO in crisis, What's going to be the big things next year for our readers and listeners that want to listen to us over the Christmas break to think about next year? Alan, where do you see us?
I think the overwhelmingly important subject or event will take place on the first Tuesday in November, which is the US presidential election. And that's not just the policy from then on. It's the fact that in many cases, certainly with the EU, with its ongoing sort of mini negotiation with the US and probably also China, there's an extent to which people are looking forward to that event already. Certainly, EU is in effect filibustering the Trump administration. Yes. It's keeping them talking. What they're talking about is actually fairly minimal, but as long as they're talking, then Donald Trump is less likely to hit the EU with all the threats that he thought that he's been waving at them. And so the question from their point of view is, can that hold for nearly 11 months? What mood will Donald Trump be in over the year? You know, people always say, oh, an election comes up, that means he's in deal-making mode. He wants to show that he's got deals. He doesn't want to upset the financial markets. But then I just had looked back recently at the history of his decisions, and really there is no consistent pattern here whatsoever. He took a lot of his big decisions to ramp up the trade war at a time when the S&P 500 was actually looking kind of weak. And it's quite possible that instead of being in deal-making mode ahead of an election, you know, he's going to be in warrior mode because he wants to gin up his base. But I think that essentially, you know, sort of looking backwards from November is going to dominate really pretty much everyone's or all the big countries' issues with world trade and their attitudes to world trade.
But isn't the hope, if I may, the hope of the EU and that a different president would be very different? Isn't that a bit of a naive hope? I mean, Elizabeth Warren and the Democrats have certainly massively toughened up their rhetoric on China, their rhetoric on global trade. I mean, Elizabeth Warren, will she really be an easier president to deal with in terms of trade policies?
I think she'll be a lot less aggressive. I can't see her starting a lot of cases or imposing a lot of tariffs on the basis of national security, for example, which is what Donald Trump says. I think, you know, certainly she'll be quite robust. I don't think any trade deals would get signed under President Warren because she's going to load them up with so many conditions. I mean, it's interesting, actually, that the NAFTA version 2, the USMCA, is just going through Congress with a lot of additions by the Democrats, in fact, to do with Labour and so on. Still, I think it's hard to imagine President Warren signing very big deals with other countries. But, you know, I think trade policy in the US might well go into stasis rather than anything else. But if you want, just to go back to our original subject, if you want to resurrect the WTO, I think that's far more likely under President Warren. If everyone else, you know, gives way and compromises, and she could portray it as a victory for the US, then I think there's a lot more chance there, certainly with Donald Trump. And certainly I think one thing that people will welcome is that even if her policy is not a lot softer, it will almost certainly be a lot more predictable. Because the one thing that we can see about Elizabeth Warren is her temperament is infinitely calmer than
Donald Trump. Alicia, from your point of view, China's point of view, but also the US point of view, where do you see trade next year?
Okay. So I think we're going to have a kind of a delay in the imposition of additional tariffs, some 90 billion on mainly consumer goods imported into the US from China, which is going to be like our small but relevant Christmas gift. This will basically be interpreted by the market as, okay, you know, at least they just didn't close the thing without any agreement. And that brings us to the beginning of the year. And I frankly think we're going to see more and more of these negotiations for the very little mini deal delaying. So this is uncertainty, additional uncertainty, harming the Chinese economy, harming sentiment globally, and certainly North Asia. I mean, we're looking at how Korea is swallowing the trade war, probably even worse than China. I mean, in terms of its impact, the impact on the Korean value chain. So it's bad news, but I think that's where we are. I frankly think that we are still very far on the reform of the WTO. The collapse or the demise of the appellate body might accelerate these discussions on the reform, but we're still very far apart in terms of the EU proposal and China's proposal. So yeah, kind of stalemate. And I don't want to talk about the elections because Alan, the US elections, Alan has covered it all. But even
what about the EU China?
Forgetting about that, I think it's a very, like, you know, kind of wait and see in the worst of all sentiment for Asia on trade. Yeah.
So what about EU China investment deal? Yeah. Will that advance next year?
Well, we have this event, Guntram, as you know, in Leipzig. I believe it's October. You know, it's a big summit, EU-China summit, with all of the 28 members being present. And it would be kind of the nice place, thinking about Germany's privileged, if I may say, relations with China. It would be a nice place to sign this bilateral investment agreement. My sense is that we're really, really far still on our key beliefs. The on the European side is really about, again, SOE, reciprocity, market access. We know what the EU is looking for. On the Chinese side, there's still this expectation, which to me seems kind of strange for where we are and where they are with the US at the moment, which is that Chinese companies should be treated differently on the basis that they are still in a development phase in terms of complying with the labor regulations, environmental regulations in Europe. So, you know, very far apart if you think about it. So, yes, I think it'll be a tough call to think we'll get a deal by that summit in Leipzig.
All right. Thanks a lot. So not a lot of optimism for next year, but I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening, and please join us again in our podcast. This time it was a podcast with Alan Beattie from the Financial Times and Alicia Garcia Herrero from Bruegel. Thank you for joining. Bye-bye.